Mosaic, how are we doing this morning? It's good to see you guys. If you're a guest with us, you're stepping into a conversation we've been having for 3 weeks. And this morning is the final week on this Palm Sunday, talking about kingdom economics. And we're talking about money, of all things, believe it or not. And we've really committed to really talk about money the same way that we talk about anything as a community, and that is candidly and openly and with grace. And so to set up this morning's conversation, I want to share a story with you. If you've been around Mosaic for a long time, you've heard a little bit of this before, but if you know anything about me, I grew up in a home where we didn't have a lot of money. Just didn't. Had four kids. My parents, my dad was really the breadwinner, and he was a youth pastor, and they paid him mostly in hugs. And so we didn't have a lot of money. My mom made most of our clothes, and I grew up in a rural town in southern Minnesota. And then when I was in eighth grade, we moved to a resort community in central Minnesota. Very nice. I think there's 300 lakes within 15 square miles. It's gorgeous, but a very affluent Scandinavian community. And so we moved there, and everybody had money, it seemed, except for me. And so I felt like a fish out of water immediately. And it really didn't fit in. And I remember that year because we moved and things were very tight. And I grew 11 inches in 11 months that year. So I was right in the throes of all kinds of fun stuff. But I needed new clothes, and we could only afford to buy me one pair of jeans. And I wasn't very smart about it. Boss was like big back then. Remember Boss? And I wasn't subtle. I bought these jeans, and the Boss logo was horizontal, the letters Boss, and it went from my butt cheek to the back of my knee. You know, and so very quickly, classmates realized that I was wearing the same pair of pants pretty much every day. And they started to make fun of me. And I was actually bullied for a while. And that year, I got my first job working at a car wash. And I got that job specifically so I could buy clothes. And I remember the day I got my first paycheck, and I walked into like JCPenney or whatever our department store was, and I bought myself a more subtle pair of brand new jeans, and I bought myself a Fila tennis polo. Like Mace used to wear. And I remember the next day walking into school, and for the first time in a long time, I felt normal. And that year, I bought a lot of clothes. And it changed in time, not only how I felt about me, but I learned a lot of things. I learned a very important lesson as it relates to money, even as a middle schooler, and that is that money is an incredibly powerful tool. Money helped me change how I felt about me. And I realized with money, in time, I could actually change the way people perceived me. You know, money has that ability. As we grow older, we realize, you know, money can actually make us feel more secure. Money can make us look smarter than we actually are. Donald Trump, right? Right, money's powerful. Maybe that's one of the reasons the Bible in general, and Jesus specifically, spends so much time talking about money, because money really is powerful. Right, money can be used to build up, and money can be used to tear down. You know, money can be used to create, and money can be used to destroy. Money can be used to serve the poor, or money can be used to take advantage of the poor. Right, money can be used to work towards justice, and money can be used to further propagate injustice. And so money is very important, and Jesus actually points to the truth over and over and over again that there are eternal implications to money. Money largely shapes the world in which we live, the outer world, and what he says is inevitably that money will and does shape our inner world, based largely on what we do with it, right? And so that's why it's so important. And this morning, what I want to do is I want to actually look at one of the strangest parables that Jesus ever told. It's a very bizarre parable, and it's a parable that's been mistranslated at times and used to justify all kinds of bizarre behavior, but I want to look at it, and I think you're going to catch this as we lean in, because it really is so incredibly important and has some hugely profound things for us, especially as it relates to what we do with our money. So that said, I want to open up to Luke chapter 16, beginning in verse 1, and I will say this on the front end. There's a part of me that loves to talk about money, first of all, because it's one of the few conversations we can have that is relevant to every single one of us, as all of us will and do have money that will pass through our hands that God entrusts us to us. But I also say this, that what we're about to talk about has the ability to change your life. It really does. And I'm not one for making huge promises, but the younger you are, the more true that this is. Right? If you will hear what's said and put it into practice, it literally can change your life. All right, so here we go, beginning in verse 1. Jesus told his disciples this. He's going to tell them a parable. There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. Right? In the first century, rich people, if you were a rich person, what you'd often do is you would take your best and brightest servant and you would train them in how to manage your wealth. It's a very prestigious place, role for a servant to take. And so this guy has been entrusted with managing his owner's wealth, and he's being accused of mismanaging it. We don't know if that actually is what took place, but at least he's being accused of it. And so in verse 2, it says, "So he called him in, and he asked him this. He said, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer.'" Right? He wants him to give an account for how he's been using this guy's money. Not because he's going to decide whether or not, you know, it's true or false. It's all, the decision's been made. He's losing his job, but he needs to give an account of what he's been doing with it. So in verse 3, he says, the manager says this to himself. He says, "What shall I do now? My master's taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. So I know what I'll do. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." Verse 5, so he called in each one of his master's debtors, and he's going to start striking deals with all these guys that owe his master money. He asked the first guy, "How much do you owe my master?" He said, 900 gallons of olive oil. And the manager told him, "Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. So he cuts the guy's debt in half. Right? And at this point, right, 900 gallons of olive oil, that's about 1,000 denarii. Denarii is a one day's wage. So basically you've got 3 years' wages worth of debt being represented here that he's cutting in half, which is a ton. You can about imagine. He's going to be very, very excited about this. If you have any debt, right, you know, just imagine what this would feel like. If you got student loan debt, for example, I've got $60,000 of student loan debt. If you came to me and you said, "Hey, I'm going to pay off half of that today," I would kiss you on the mouth. Right? I don't care if you have a mustache, I'm kissing you, right? Because debt is just, it's huge. And this debt is way more than what I have in student loan debt. And this manager says, look, and this, by the way, is legally binding because of his role. So this is how much debt this guy now has. He cuts it, wipes it in half. Then we're told this. Then he asks a second, "How much do you owe?" He said, 1,000 bushels of wheat. So the manager told him, "Take your bill and make it 800. Right, 1,000 bushels of wheat. At this point, this was about 2,500 to 3,000 denarii. Right, so this is 8 to 10 years worth of wages. This is a huge debt. And he's going to cut 20% off, a fifth of it, just like that. And we don't know why it's less. Maybe it's just because of the enormity of the debt. Maybe it's the materials that he's working with. But again, you'd be pretty pumped about this. If you own a home, right, and the bank came to you and said, "Hey, we're just going to knock a fifth off and pay down 20% of your mortgage for you. Happy birthday," right? You'd be very excited. And that's exactly what the manager is doing here. And this is where it gets a little bizarre for us, all right? This is where it's like, I'm sorry, what? In verse 8, the master calls him in. And he commends the dishonest manager because he has acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. So Jesus says, "I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it's gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings." What? Right? Right? And so let's lean in. So here's the thing. I'm only going to take a minute to address this, but we don't know exactly what's going on here. Whether this is the case, but one of the more popular theories in trying to interpret this particular little nuance of the text, right, is that the manager basically has been imposing his own funds on top of the debt, right? He had the ability to do that. He gets to pad his own pockets, make some money for himself, right? And so in going and knocking out part of these big debts and forgiving them, part of what he's doing is eliminating his fees. And so the owner is coming to him and saying, look, you're wise, you're smart cookie. You know what you're doing. And not only are you making friends for yourself for when I fire you, because I'm going to fire you, he says, because you're knocking off your fees that you've put on this debt, you're actually giving me a better reputation in town too. You know, and so that's a theory. Truth is, we don't know. We don't know if that's the case. But when it comes to parables, we can't get lost in the details of the parable because the parables are like a joke, right? And when it comes to jokes, it's all about the punchline. Right, and so if you're a fan of stand-up comedy, I'm a big fan of stand-up comedy. We were watching some last night. Right, if you listen to a person, they're telling a story, they're setting you up for something. Right, and then comes the punchline, boom. It's all about the punchline. Right, when it comes to Jesus' parables, right, we can't get lost in the details of the story because there's always one central truth that Jesus is trying to communicate through a parable. And in this particular case, what Jesus is trying to get across is really, really clear. Right? He goes out of his way to make it really clear. And he says, look, here's this man that is being really shrewd, really wise with his finances. He's doing it in a dishonest way, but he's being very smart about this. Right? And he bemoans the fact that when it comes to disciples, kingdom people, that people who don't give a rip about God, they don't care, they're just out to make a buck, that they actually take, they're more wise with their finances oftentimes than church people, Christians, disciples. And so this whole parable, the whole point is about us being wise in how we use our wealth, how we manage our wealth. That's where Jesus is going. So knowing that, I basically just want to draw out three big things that we see here that Jesus has for us. The first one is brief, but it's really hard-hitting, right? And you're taking notes. Number one, we are stewards of money that is not ours. Right, we're stewards of money that is not ours. One of the things that Jesus does immediately is he likens us to a manager. Right, the word in the Greek is oikonomos. You don't need to know that; it just makes me sound smarter. Right, but literally, what it means is it's a house distributor. Right, it's an overseer. It's a manager. Another word that's often used in the translation is steward. Right, and the reason he uses that is because the whole point is the money doesn't belong to this guy. It's just been entrusted to his care, right? And so Jesus is saying, like, when it comes to us, you and I, we're managers of money that ultimately it's not ours, right? It's just on loan, right? And the important implication of this, right, is like, if in fact that's true, if there is a God, and if Jesus was him, and if what he's saying is true, when it comes to managing somebody else's money, that means we don't actually get to do just whatever we want with the money, right? Because it's not ours, right? So Jesus, on the front end, the very first thing he's pointing out is, look, it's not your money, right? Stop acting like it is, which is really hard for us Americans. I think us more than most, right? Because generally, at least in my conversations with people I'm connected to, the general sentiment is like, look, I've worked very hard for this, right? I logged the hours, right? I chose not to become this or that. I chose this career path. I went to school for this. I've got the student loan debt to show for it, right? I've said no to a lot of distractions. I've worked very hard for this. I've logged the hours. The money is mine. And what Jesus is saying is actually no, it's not. You know, and it's not to take away from anybody who works very hard, is very frugal with their finances and very wise, right? Yes, you've worked very hard, but I think what we have to think about, at least briefly, is yeah, you've worked hard, but with what? Right? First of all, you're alive, which helps enormously if you're trying to make money, right? It's very hard to make money if you're dead, right? We're alive, right? And this is, we didn't earn that, right? It's just a gift that God has given you and that's grace, by the way, right? We're alive. Secondly, we're healthy. At least many of us are healthy enough to work, right? And generally, this is part of the reason we get very frustrated when we're not healthy enough to work, right? We ask questions like, God, why would you let this happen? How could you let this happen? Right, but here's another different way of thinking about it. Right, I don't know if you ever took a human anatomy class. I'm guessing most of us did. One of my least favorite classes I ever took because it was so hard. There's so much to learn. Right, and anybody who studied the human body knows, like, it's such an intricate, amazing thing, the human body. And there's so many things that have to function just right for somebody to get up and get out of bed in the morning and just go about their lives, you know? And as somebody who's coming into their mid-30s, I'm realizing, like, we live in a fallen world where this is, like, this whole thing is starting to wear out, you know? Like, this week, I was like, Megan, I threw my elbow out, you know? I was like, what is going on? She's like, what did you do? I was like, I was brushing my teeth, and I didn't do anything, you know? And you know, part of, like, another way of thinking about it is just, like, ask, instead of asking, like, God, why would you allow this to happen, is ask, why in the world does God bother to keep us held together for so long? Why is that? It's just a gift. Life in and of itself is a gift. Health is a gift. And what about your talents, right? That enables you to actually go and make that money, right? Your ability, your ability to think and do these different things. And how about your circumstances, right? The fact that you get to live in 2016 in the United States is a pretty extraordinary thing. And you might be a very hard worker, but if you were born on a mountain in Tibet in the 13th century or in Haiti this century, right, and a number of other places in the world, truth is it doesn't matter how hard you work. Chances are you're going to end up poor with very little to show for it, and that's just your lot in life, right? And so I don't want to take away from the fact that, hey, yeah, you work hard. That's great. That's a God-honoring thing. It sure can be, right? But right? We work hard with the life God's given us, the talent God's given us, the health God's given us, the circumstances God has given us. None of it belongs to us. All of it is His. And that's the reason, by the way, David can say some pretty bold words, who is a very wealthy man, by the way. And in 1 Chronicles 29, he'd say things like this. You know, everything in heaven and earth comes from your hand, right? All of it belongs to you, right? Who am I? Verse 14, who am I, right? Who are my people that we should be able to give as generously as this? Everything comes from you, and we have given you only what comes from your hand. It all belongs to you. So I want to just sit here just for a second and just consider if, let's just say this is true, right? If there is a God, and if, in fact, he has given us this life and these circumstances and our health and our talent, and all of it belongs to him, and we're just stewards, we're just fund managers for a finite period of time, right? That means, right, if we're not being radically generous, right, as God calls us to repeatedly in the Bible, then to quote Tim Keller, who's much smarter than me, but he's spot on when he says this. He says this, if you're not then being radically generous, this is not just stinginess, it's robbery. It's not just miserliness, it's thievery. Right? It's not just a lack of compassion, it's a lack of integrity. Right? And that's something we got to actually consider. If all we are is a steward of things that are ultimately not ours, and we're just been entrusted to us, for a period of time, right? If we're taking more for ourselves than what God, you know, the original agreement was, then it's not just not being compassionate, it's actually stealing from our Creator. And this is, Malachi 3 says this probably as explicitly as anywhere in the Bible. This is what it says, Malachi 3:8. He says this, God sends us to say this to his people. He says, will mere mortal rob God? Yet you do, you rob me. But you ask, how are we robbing you? And he says this, God says, in tithes and offerings. Now in the Old Testament, some of you already know this, but in the Old Testament, right, tithing just means tenth, right? And the idea was the bare minimum that God's people would need to be giving away was 10%. There's some other things going on, but that was kind of the bare minimum. You know, and for us, I don't know about you, but so I didn't really get trained in how to do this whole money thing really well. And Megan and I, we just kind of lived like everybody else for a very long time, right? If you had money in the bank, you're free to spend it. You know, generally, that's exactly what we did. But as long as you're in the black, you know, you're smart, you're doing well. We didn't give 10% away for a long time, I will say that, right? And for those who find themselves there, it's like, we hear that, it's like, man, 10%, how'd they do that? Right? That's a ton of money. Right, but imagine this. Imagine somebody came to you, somebody very well off, and they said, hey, I want you to manage my wealth. I have a lot of assets. I want to put them in your care, invest them as you will, and every year I want you to, you can keep 90% of the return, just give me 10%. Right? How many of us want that job, right? Let me pray about it. Yes, I would. You know, it doesn't matter if you know anything about money, right? Nobody in Lincoln, Nebraska has those terms. Right? But it's what he's saying, Malachi, and Jesus said, this is exactly what God has done, right? It's all on loan. None of it is ours. 10% in the Old Testament, right? 10% goes back to God. 90% of it, essentially, it's yours to do what you will with. Eat, drink, and be merry. Work hard, create something beautiful with your life. Give it away, do whatever you will. But 10% needs to go back to me, right? And Malachi really leans in and says, look, if you're not giving that, you're actually robbing God. And God had some things he wanted to talk to them about. Now, one of the things I run into a lot, some of you are already there, and you're waiting to see if I'm going to address this, right? One of the things that church people tend to get a little frustrated with this idea, right? And people will regularly, you know, ask me, like, come on, Aaron, that was Old Testament, right? Do you really believe that New Testament Christians are legally obligated to give 10%? To which I always say, no, I don't believe that, you know? And there's like this, you know, like they're happy with me. They feel very affirmed in their skepticism. You know, they're like, all right, we're on the same page. You know, but then I've got some questions for them too, though. And I think they're questions that we got to wrestle with a little bit as it relates to our money. Right? And part of that is, you know, I ask, look, when you look at the Old Testament, what people were invited and called to, and then you look on the other side of the cross, what disciples of Jesus are invited and called to, would you say that we're called to more or less? Right? This is when their posture starts to change. They start to get a little pissed at me. right? And then it's like, you know, and they have to admit, well, yeah, I think we're called to more, right? Pick up your cross, right? And follow me, die to yourself. Like, that's the call, right? And then you ask, like, look, when you look at the Old Testament believers, you look at New Testament believers, would you say that we are given more blessing or less? Right, more revelation or less, more favor or less, more grace or less, right? And so you're going to tell me, so here's where the rub is, right? It's like you're going to tell me, right, in 2016, right, in a time in human history when we are called to be a light in the darkness, a city on a hill, Jesus' hands and feet in a world that desperately needs him, you're going to sit there and argue with me and tell me we're supposed to give less and be less generous as a people? Right, and so that's the rub. And some of you aren't very happy with me, and I can see it. You're punching me in the face with your eyes and your facial expression right now, and that's okay. That's okay. The point is, we got to wrestle with this. Right, and if what Tim Keller suggests, if what Jesus suggests, if what Malachi says is remotely applicable to us, then we have to wrestle with the idea that maybe just maybe what we have is not ours. And maybe just maybe if we refuse to give access to that stuff that we're clutching on to, namely our money, that maybe just maybe it's not just that we're being uncompassionate, but maybe just maybe we're actually robbing God because it all belongs to him anyway. Maybe just maybe. All right, secondly, number two, if you're taking notes, we're called to be shrewd with resources God has entrusted to us. Shrewd with that money. The word shrewd here in the Greek, all it means is to be clever, right? To be wise, to be prudent, right? To live with foresight on what's coming, to be clever. I love that, right? So Jesus says this, right? This is what Jesus says to us in this parable. He says, look, those of you who belong to me, who are my disciples, who are my kingdom people, I want you to think about your wealth in the same way that this shrewd manager thought about his wealth. Namely, that it wasn't his, and that very soon he was going to lose everything, right? Because like him, you know, eventually you are going to lose everything. Right, and even though he could care less about God and really lived in this kingdom of this world kind of a way, right, you know that this kingdom is passing away and that God's kingdom is coming in its fullness. Right? So think like the shrewd manager and take action now. Right? Live like you know that all of this is temporary and eternity lasts forever. Right, and it's coming soon. Use your wisdom, your relationships, your resources, everything that's available to you to be wise, to be clever, to be prudent. With what God has entrusted to you. And then Jesus actually says, and you know what, sadly, right, the people who could care less about God or what God might call them to, sadly, the truth is they actually generally are a lot better at being shrewd with their money than our kingdom people. And he wants that to change. He calls us to be shrewd like they're shrewd, which is pretty cool, I think, but challenging at the same time. You know, for my part, I wasn't really trained in what to do with money, how to save, invest, budget, all that kind of stuff. I didn't grow in a home where we talked about that. My parents weren't taught how to do that, and so that kind of just got passed down. And I really didn't think about it. We just kind of lived like everybody else, you know, until just about 5 years ago, 6 years ago-ish, something like that. Two families that are very, very close to us, that we trust, that we look up to, godly people, they love the Lord, both went bankrupt within 12 months of each other. One, because of some circumstances that were, for the most part, out of their control, but they weren't positioned to be able to rebound because they hadn't saved much, they hadn't invested much. And the other, because he lost his job, and sadly, he got a job. The income was returned to him 3 months later, but he didn't have enough to survive 3 months, and so both families went bankrupt. And that was like the wake-up call for our family, and I realized, I got to learn how to do this. Because up until then, we had been doing just the normal thing and looking around us for cues on what we ought to be entitled to, right, and how we are to live, right? And I want to paint just a little bit of a picture of normal for you, because if we don't take our cues from Jesus and we take our cues culturally, this is where we are generally, right? On the average in the U.S., this is what normal is. First of all, living above our means, right? Mike said last week, right, the average American has $15,000 in credit card debt, the average, right? And some of us, that's where we're at, you know, and you're like, yes, average, yeah, things are better than I thought. It's not good, though. It's not good. And I say that because over 70% of people who claim bankruptcy all point to credit cards and say that's the primary reason. We just got so upside down, we couldn't dig ourselves out of that hole. Secondly, living above our means, financing things we don't need. something that is just commonplace. But Aaron, it's 0% interest. I know, but you do know. Listen to this. 88% of those 0% interest things convert into debt. 88%. The bank is betting on the fact that sometime in the next 3 to 5 years, you're going to have one late payment. It's all it takes. And the moment that that happens, what they do is they tack on all the interest from before. It all adds up. They can legally do that. And usually it's an interest rate that is at 25% or above, right, which is dishonest. That's rob you blind kind of interest rate. But that's how they're set up. They are banking on the fact that you're going to miss a payment. That's where they make their money. And odds are good, 88%. Normal is living with very little margin, which means we aren't saving. And when things go wrong, we're immediately in trouble. Right, so I saw a stat this week that said this. Last year, as a country, as a whole, we saved less than 1%. As one of the wealthiest nations in the world, where the vast majority of the world lives on less than several dollars a day, as that people, we saved less than 1%. Another stat that I saw actually said we saved negative 1% last year as a nation, which means we actually collectively all went into debt, which is mind-blowing. But apparently it's true. Money Magazine reports that in the next several years, 78% of us in the room will have a major negative life event. So you can pretty much bank on it. 3 out of 4 chance, there's going to be some kind of negative life event. And here's where it gets dicey, and here's the problem, is that 49% of Americans could cover less than 1 month's expenses if they lost their income. Those two things together are a recipe for bankruptcy. That's why so many people end up there. Right, normal also means that we aren't investing for the future. Right, listen to this. 80% of Americans believe that their standard of living will increase when they retire. 80% believe that, but 56% of them do not systematically prepare for retirement age by investing. I don't know if we're banking on Social Security, but you might as well believe in UFOs if you think Social Security is going to cover you. Right, most of us don't do that. And so here's the reality. Here's the reality right now. USA Today reports that out of 100 people aged 65 and up, 97 of those 100 people can't write a check for $600. Right? And so 54 of them are still working because they have to. The rest, we assume, are either in bankruptcy or on their way to bankruptcy. Only 3 out of the 100 are financially secure. Only 3. Right, and the reason that this is such a big deal, guys, and the reason we're talking about this in church, maybe it feels like this isn't a church conversation. The reason it's so important is, one, not only does debt and living this way rob us of the ability to live generously as God calls us to, but even just as importantly, it doesn't have to be this way. It really doesn't have to be this way. And in fact, I would say as Americans living in 2016, we have more opportunities and tools available to us, arguably, than any other people in human history. Right, it doesn't have to. In fact, I would say this, like with the exception of maybe a few rare circumstances that might be represented in the room, the vast majority of us, we should never, right, if we're shrewd with our finances, ever be in a place where we're up to our eyeballs in debt, where we're living hand to mouth, where we're worried what's going to happen when we turn 65. We don't have to, but what it's going to require is actually doing what Jesus calls us to, and that is living shrewdly, part of which means learning how to handle our finances. Right, so I just want to give you a taste, just a little taste of how this works. For example, right, most people statistically will carry a car payment for their entire lives. Right? That's just a part of the normal thing. Most of us have car payments. We've seen them modeled for us, and we just assume that that's a necessity. Right, the average, when it comes out, with all things considered, the average of that payment is $378 a month. If you were to take that, instead of spending it on a car, and you were to invest that just in a common mutual fund, right, and that mutual fund just averaged what the stock market has averaged for the last 80 plus years, which is 12%. And you start investing that just monthly in between age 25 to 65. By the time you turn 65, you would have about $4.5 million in that account. Right, that's just the way that compounding interest works. Right, which means if you can pay the car payment for the rest of your life if it's that important to you, but you will in the process, just so you know, blow a lifetime's wealth doing it. Right, so part of being shrewd is just knowing this and deciding what it is we really want. Right, leasing, by the way, is even worse. They don't have to report this to you or to the government, but on average, you're going to be paying about 14% interest, and you'll have nothing to show for it when you're done. Comparable to that would be maybe buying a new car, And I realize I'm stepping on some toes, but we are a young church, and people need to know this, right? If you buy a new car, that car is going to depreciate in value about 60% in the first 4 years, right? So if you buy a car for, say, $28,000, new car, in the first 4 years, you're going to lose $17,000 of value in that car, which is the equivalent, by the way, of throwing a $100 bill out the window every week for 4 years. Right, so if you want to feel what that rush is like, I'd encourage you to drive down 46th Street, and once you get to about Van Dorn or so where my house is, just throw a $100 bill out there every week, and I'll send my kids out there to collect those for the next 4 years. Right? It's huge. Listen to this. So over 97% do not systematically pay down more than they need to on their mortgage. Right, which is substantial. So for example, if you have just a $150,000 30-year mortgage at 4%, which is pretty standard, right, and you would pay just one extra mortgage payment a year, which is less than $100 a year, right, you would pay off $17,000 that you wouldn't have to pay ahead of time, and you would be done with your mortgage 4 years quicker. Right, and this is even more substantial. If you work somewhere and you eat out every day, 5 days a week, if you were to pack your lunch every day and take that money and push it towards your mortgage, you would pay off your mortgage almost 12 years ahead of time. Right? Again, I mean, that's huge. We don't think this way, because if we're looking for cues around us, what's normal, you can live that way, but you can also live differently, which is what I'm trying to help us see. We have a lot of young people in this church, a lot of young families, people with kids. One of the great things about having kids is you get a tax return. Great tax breaks with kids. If you're single or you're married, thinking about having kids is a great reason to have kids. There are other good reasons too, in case you're wondering, but the tax break is great. But listen to this. If you don't invest a dollar before you're 35, but you just took $3,000 of your tax return and you pushed that into a Roth IRA, and again, it just averages 12%, and you just invested that from 35 to 65, right? In a Roth IRA, by the time you're 65, you're going to have almost $1 million in there. You've only invested $90,000, but that's how compounding interest works. And because it's in a Roth IRA, you get all that money back tax-free. Guys, this isn't even hard. I'm telling you, any of us can do this. But it does require being shrewd, right? It does require asking hard conversations about the kind of lifestyle we're living. Might require some adjustments and some simplifying. And rather than just spending everything, doing some saving and investing. But any of us, I'm convinced any of us can do this, right? Just so you know, the average family, right? We and I said this the first week, and I just want to repeat it because it's so important, right? As some of the wealthiest people in the world, I know you don't feel that way, but we will have more money go through our hands than the vast majority of people who have ever lived and who live now. The average family will have over $2 million pass through their hands in their lifetime. It's just the average, right? And we are going to have to stand before God and give an account for what we did with that, right? And so if you've never, like I was never trained, if you're never trained in just how to handle this, how to do this wisely, how to invest wisely. This is exactly the reason we're offering Financial Peace University starting March 30th. It's going to be at 7 p.m. on Wednesdays, right through that door. Right? And if you've never had anybody walk alongside you and just train you how to do this, we would love to do that. Right? Because if I'm really honest with you, I want you to make a stupid amount of money. I do. I want you to accumulate so much money so that you can invest it into kingdom things. Right? The church needs more people who do the shrewd thing, so we can fund Jesus' kingdom mission in this world better and more aggressively, rather than all of us just living up to our eyeballs in debt and living hand to mouth because we buy stuff we can't afford with money we don't have to impress people in the end we really don't like. So that's my plug for Financial Peace. But there's one last thing. There's one last thing before I land the plane that I want us to see in this text. And it's so important, right? And it really is where Jesus is pointing us to. It's the punchline, or where the punchline points us to, and that is what Jesus, the purpose of being shrewd, the reason that Jesus calls us to be shrewd, and if you're taking notes, number three, it's this, we are called to invest primarily and most generously in people, right? That's the whole point, right? The point of building wealth and investing and paying off debt and not being dumb is not just to make a lot of money for money's sake. Right? And it's not just to generate more income and freedom so that we can amass more things for ourselves. The whole point, right, is to be wise and to build wealth so that we can invest as much as possible in this life into people. Right? That's the whole point. Right? The only thing, like this life will be over, right? And we know in the scope of eternity, this life is a blip on the radar screen of eternity. And when this life is over, the only things that we get to take with us are people. It's the only thing that's eternal. Everything else is dust, right? The house is dust. The car is dust, right? The landscaping outside and all the decor inside is dust. Your money is all dust, right? And you can take that money and you can send it to a vault in the bottom of a mountain in Switzerland, right? But just so you know, in the end, all mountains become dust as well, right? The only thing that is eternal and the only thing that we can invest in where we actually get to enjoy the returns of our investment for eternity is in people, right? And so just speaking candidly for myself, this is why for us, like for our family anyway, the first 10% that we give away and invest comes to this church, right? And it's been that way even when we started the church and I was making 20-some thousand dollars and with only income for a family of four, we could do this, right? People can do this. I really do believe that if we say no to things. But for us, we do it and we do it joyfully, right? Because for us, investing in our church family, whether it's Mosaic, whether someday God takes us somewhere else, we'll do the same there. Because we really believe that it's an investment in people. The church is people, right? It's an investment in people that are waking, we're awakening a little bit more and a little bit more to the person of Jesus and the reality of the kingdom of God. Or it's an investment in my spiritual family that I'm going to get to spend eternity with. Right? It's an investment in people in our city who don't know Jesus yet. Now, here's the thing. My takeaway is not, hey, you need to give 10%. Invest it in Mosaic Ministries. All right, peace out. That's not where I'm going with this. Right? The truth is, you can invest in people in a lot of different ways. It doesn't just have to be in any church, let alone Mosaic, for example. And that's the reason, like, we give above and beyond that 10% to other things, other kingdom things, right? We support some missionaries in Berlin, and we support a child through World Vision, and we give, you know, to different things through World Vision, tangible needs, also to International Justice Mission, which fights human trafficking on an amazing systematic level. And then, of course, we give to, you know, just the cool things that we get to do as a church throughout the year, like, you know, hooking up some of Lincoln's homeless population with brand new kicks. You know, it's investment in people. But that's the thing, right? In all of those things that you'll see a common thread, and that common thread is first and foremost, it's an investment in people, right? And for our family's sake, we're trying to up that percentage year after year because it's the only thing that is eternal. And by the way, I'll also point out, for us, part of this means not only just investing in tangible needs and physical needs, even though those are important, but investing the best of what we have to invest in spiritual needs. Right, and organizations and movements that are helping people bump into Jesus and recognize that there is a God who's crazy about you, right? Who knows you by name, who has promised to never leave you, to never forsake you, right? Who marched to the cross on Good Friday, who rose from the dead on Easter, right? And who sends his people out to share that message with an unbelieving and desperate world, right? And so all of that to say, I know this is uncomfortable. I know it's challenging. I know I'm messing with your stuff and maybe with your head a little bit, but I do want to challenge us. I think it's the risk, it's worth the risk of offending people to have this conversation. Because as a pastor, I can't help but imagine what we could do if we actually did this. And I want to just, I promise I'm landing the plane right now. Right, but this is from an article recently posted on Relevant Magazine. And this is huge. Just some numbers. I know I'll just keep throwing numbers at you. Hopefully one of them sticks. But listen to this. Okay, so in the U.S. as a whole, all right, only 5% actually tithe. All right, that bare minimum, that 10%, only 5%. With 80% of Americans only giving 2% of their income. All right, that's normal. Christians are only giving at 2.5% per capita, which, by the way, is lower than during the Great Depression, which was 3.3%. All right, like I said at the beginning of the series, I don't think that this is just a issue for us in the West. I really do think this is the issue. But listen to this. If believers were to increase their giving to a minimum of, let's just say, 10%, we'll cap it right there, there would be an additional tomorrow, and I know not all of us can do this overnight, but there would be an additional $165 billion for the movement of Jesus to use and distribute. And this is how that breaks down. $25 billion could relieve global hunger, starvation, and deaths from preventable diseases in 5 years. All of it. $12 billion could eliminate illiteracy in 5 years globally. $15 billion could solve the world's water and sanitation issues, specifically at places in the world where 1 billion people live on less than $1 a day. $1 billion could fully fund all overseas mission work. And that would leave $100 to $110 billion still left over for the movement of Jesus to use for other things. Right, those are mind-blowing numbers. And by the way, that's just if we're faithful with what we already have. So imagine what we could do if actually we were both faithful and shrewd. We could do anything. And here's the thing. I really believe that even in a church of 400 people, that if we would do this, we could make such a big kingdom splash that our city and our world could not ignore it. Right? And that's what I'm praying for. All right, Lord, may it be so. All right, let me pray for you. Lord God, I know that this is can be a very uncomfortable issue. It's personal for every single one of us. And I know I'm drawing into question some of our spending decisions, some of the things that we've adopted in our lifestyle. I'm messing with our stuff and maybe with our heads a little bit. But Lord, I really do believe that sometimes the truth hurts. And we got to hear it. And regardless of where we might find ourselves today walking in here, maybe some of us are so overwhelmed with debt, we don't even know where to start. We don't know how to flip the script and dig our way out of where we're at. And so, Lord, even in this moment, I ask that you would be speaking into our heart, our soul, every single one of us in this room, giving us eyes to see what maybe we haven't seen before. I want to see what you can do. So, Lord God, we come before you now from a lot of different places, but as your church. I pray these things in your name. Amen.